Välkommen till Freuds Toolbox, skolans inspirationspodd med fokus på känslor, relationer, lärande och ledarskap. Tillsammans med Kenneth Freud får du inspireras av och lära av nationellt och internationellt ledande experter på evidensbaserat lärande och ledarskap.
Hi everyone. In today's episode, we will talk about stress in schools. I think that is a really important subject in not only in Sweden, in any country, all countries. And therefore, I invited Daniel Rosen. I'll let him introduce himself, but I invited him because he focused a lot on what you can do with stress, so coping with stress and stress reactions in school. That is an area of great interest for me, and I hope for every listener as well. So welcome, Daniel.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on. Lovely to be a part of the show, as it were.
Okay, could you introduce yourself a little bit? What you're a school leader, but you're also background as a teacher, or you teach as well. But you,
yes.
No, you're a school leader. Yeah, you teach as well.
Yes, absolutely. So currently, I'm the head of a secondary school, an international secondary school in Germany. So that's kind of, it's a British international school. So years 7 to 13, which is age ranges 11 to 19. I originally trained as a science teacher, specializing in biology. But my undergraduate degree is basically neuroscience and psychology. My master's and PhD are pharmacology. So I've always had an interest in kind of the brain, psychology, a lot to do with medicines and drugs as well. I always had an interest in kind of how the mind and brain work. And so I've been teaching biology since I've started. I had an opportunity to start teaching psychology as well, which I've absolutely loved and continued to do. And now, whilst I teach very little, obviously due to my role, I do teach IB Diploma Biology and IB Diploma Psychology as well as a bit of TOK, actually, which is always fun, but mostly biology and psychology.
Interesting. And a colleague of mine, Eva Hartel, said that you also had organized a research ed conference. That's right.
Yeah, very much. We were very, very lucky. Eva came to speak actually at our first one. Very fortunate that the school group supports such an endeavor. And yeah, we were lucky enough to host a research ed. We've hosted two now at our school. And it's fantastic, not just in terms of professional development for staff, but also, opening up the community to seeing what is going on in educational research and hopefully helping everybody to be a little bit better.
Yeah, interesting. And that is also really easy to connect to the stress systems, I think, connect them to both to learning and well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we hosted our first one, I gave prepared a talk on stress because I feel like it's an area of kind of has huge implications in schools and education, but it's very under-talked about, and people often kind of just assume they know what they're talking about when it comes to stress and how it impacts on students and learning and the community, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, the research isn't quite so clear, and there's a lot more going on there than kind of people assume and people understand. And so I wanted to kind of delve into the research a little bit more and kind of present that in a way that staff and the community could take away and hopefully help them to deal with stress better themselves, but also help others to deal with stress, especially in an educational context.
Yeah, and when you talk about stress, how do you sort of, if you would describe the stress systems really, really quick for a teacher?
Yeah. There's kind of two main components to the stress system. There's kind of the fight or flight or freeze kind of system. I think that's what everyone kind of, is aware about. We teach it at school quite commonly at quite young ages. You see a big bear, what do? You either run away or you try to fight it, and your brain kind of kicks in and makes a decision for you. It's mediated by a lot of hormones. Adrenaline is a huge one there, obviously. But it's very, very kind of instant, well, not instantaneous, but very, very quick. And there's not much you can do about it. You will observe, sense, perceive a stressor, so something that causes
Yeah.
stress, and then your body responds to it very quickly, most notably increasing heart rate, increasing blood pressure, you know, dilating pupils, sending blood to your muscles, all those sorts of things to get you ready to bite or run away. It's a very natural response, and most kind of mammals, organisms have kind of that sort of response as well. So that's the main one. I think everyone kind of knows quite a lot about that. And then we have a secondary kind of slower one. It's called the HPA axis. And that's kind of mediated by a few different hormones. And again, it happens in slower time. But this is where kind of the stress hormone cortisol comes in, very well known. And again, this helps maintain that stress response. There's only so long you can kind of increase your heart rate in a certain way and kind of keep running in a certain way. And then the cortisol response keeps kind of the body at a level where it can respond to the stress over a period of time. Now, neither of those things is good nor bad. Obviously, you need to respond to stressors. The real problems kick in, though, when cortisol levels are really high for a prolonged period of time. And that's kind of where you see these kind of prolonged stress disorders where people have really difficult responses to stress. Either they're always stressed and that does kind of awful things to the body, or people can't respond to cortisol when it comes. And that obviously does awful things as well in terms of responding to the environment. But those are the two main kind of aspects to the stress system. They take different amounts of time to work. They work in slightly different ways. But what is really important for me to kind of emphasize is that every single aspect of those stress responses is different in everybody. So you and I will perceive different things as stressful. So we might both see a bear, but you may perceive it less stressful than I do, or more, who knows. But even then, even if we perceived it in the same way, our bodies will respond differently. So they'll send different amounts of hormone around the body. Our body will then respond differently to those different amounts of hormone. And it's kind of like a cascade effect whereby at each different step of the process, everybody's body reacts differently. And so when we talk about stress, it's really important that we do understand this kind of huge caveat that kind of underpins the entire biological system, which is everybody responds slightly differently. That's not to say that everybody is completely different. The fundamental mechanism is the same, but we can't just assume because you find something stressful that I will find something stressful. And we can't just assume that because we both find something stressful, our bodies will respond the same way.
Yeah. And now you talked about sort of the stress accelerators or that causes stress. But
yeah.
That is balanced by sort of other systems, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
There's a whole host of other systems that can balance against stress. It's quite difficult to balance against the fight or flight response, though. You'd be surprised at how difficult that is to override.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's people that train very hard, very long to do it. But I think the balance, when we're talking about education, well, I'm sure we'll come on to it later.
Yeah.
There's things you can do to mitigate the impact of stress on your kind of cognitive functions. And I think that's what's really interesting for me is that your body will do what your body does.
Yeah.
But when it comes to memory and kind of recall, there's loads of things we can do to kind of prevent the impact of stress. And I'm sure we'll talk about that in a bit.
Yeah. If you move on to the school, I think you can also, now you talk about stress, about different hormones that are released and stuff, you can also bring it up sort of to a central nervous system level and talk about sort of the sympathetic system and parasympathetic system.
Then yeah, absolutely. About,
I mean, like an accelerator and a brake.
Oh, I see. I see. Yeah, certainly. I mean, that's how you would mediate your heart rate and your kind of blood pressure things is that you have these kind of accelerators and brakes depending on which part of the nervous system we're using. So the sympathetic is kind of your accelerator and the parasympathetic kind of is the decelerator. Yeah, absolutely. We can look at that. And I think that's where lots of medicines act. But, you know, it's autonomic, right? It happens automatically. Yeah. We can't necessarily control them like in the moment. We have to kind of train our body to respond differently to things. And I think that's the real challenge for us.
Yeah. So in a school setting, then, if you have, for instance, students that have too much, too long time of stress, stress responses, that it doesn't go down. It's not in balance. It's sort of imbalanced. What do you think you could do to help them
Oh, God.
I mean,
yeah, that's a really
we
good
say
question.
That stress is natural. It has a function. But you still need to have recovery from stress. So coping with stress.
Yeah, I think there's two different kind of branches of this. I think at the extreme end, you've got people who have experienced significant trauma or significant stress over a prolonged period of time. I think that's out of the remit of a normal teacher in the normal school. I think students that have undergone that level of stress and trauma, that kind of becomes a medically diagnosable disorder, and people need professional help. That sort of thing, you can't just rebalance that by staying away from stress. You know, by the time you've under or a student has undergone that level of kind of exposure to cortisol for so long, I think that's where medical professionals need to get involved. I think teachers have an opportunity to kind of deal with the stress in their classroom, as in how can they use that for good and how can they prevent that from being bad. We also can give students strategies to ensure that when they are stressed, it doesn't actually affect their performance. And I think that's the second stage. And the likelihood of there being such significant levels of stress within a lesson is unlikely, really unlikely, unless someone has kind of a really interesting individual background. So I think for educators, for teachers, even for kind of administrators in schools, I think we're dealing with that kind of that not the extreme end of stress. That's medical professionals. We're talking about what can we do in the classroom, what can we do as a school system to prevent the impacts of stress or use stress as a benefit to learning.
Yeah, and maybe you can affect what the students do at home or their sleep, for instance. Yeah,
absolutely. Oh God, I mean, sleep is one of those huge kind of. I think sleep and exercise are two of those things that kind of. Kind of steep into all of the work on kind of mental health, whereby, you know, they're such good for kind of mental and physical well-being. That's not to say that people who do lots of exercise can't have poor mental health, but there is, you know, sufficient evidence around to show that sleep is really, really important. And when we're talking about mitigating the impact of stress, for example, in exams, sleep helps the consolidation process of memory, and therefore it's more likely that actually stress won't impact.
Yeah. Could that maybe be connected because during sleep you also have a higher parasympathetic activity? And so you're
that's
recover.
A very good question. I think that's now out of my area of expertise. Potentially, I mean, sleep. It's really fascinating. Sleep is one of those things whereby we really don't know like how it helps helps the brain kind of deal with life. I mean, we know that it's sleep, you know, or there's some evidence to suggest that sleep, you know, during sleep we kind of clear toxic things out of the brain. We obviously certainly increase our parasympathetic nervous system, certainly to calm ourselves down. Honestly, I have no idea the mechanism of action of that.
Well, it's interesting though. Yeah,
it is very much so.
I talked to a Swedish professor, Töres Theorell, who has done a lot of research in the stress area. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And he also was surprised that because we have many students that lack of sleep, he was surprised that the classroom in the morning were as calm as they were, because he said when they come in the morning with that lack of sleep, they will release adrenaline. And sitting in a classroom, they can't get any use for it other than making moves and so he thought it should be much more conflicts that there are. So he said the teachers must be really good at sort of managing their classrooms based on sort of the conditions.
But I think it's really, I think, I mean, he obviously is knows significantly more than I do. I think if we're putting it in an educational setting though, I think the reason why we won't see so much and it has a lot to do with the school culture, right? So I talked about whether you perceive something as stressful. If you go into schools where the culture hasn't yet kind of formed, whereby it's not okay to do certain things, one does see lots of, you know, where students are staying up late, messaging each other, and then they come into school and then they instantly see someone where they've had an argument with. Yeah. Actually, you will see fights. You will see kind of blow ups the first thing in the morning because the person is perceiving something as a stressor. And then will respond because they have high kind of levels of adrenaline and cortisol in their body. It makes sense. And school culture has a lot to part. If you have lots of staff on duty, if you have kind of a good peer pressure system for the for want of a better term. You know, there's a lot of peer pressure not to act in that way. Actually, that can suppress a lot of the kind of almost natural response to a stressor, in the same way that when you're in a zoo and you see a bear, you're not stressed, right? Because there's a massive cage in between you. Even though the bear is just as close as it would be, you know, without the cage, that context is really important for your perception of something being stressful. It doesn't surprise me that schools, good schools, have a system whereby actually we don't see those things. And certainly in the UK, if you go to a school whereby behavior isn't great, there will be lots of blow-ups in the morning for exactly those reasons.
And what do you think about the connection between stress and feelings among the kids?
Depends. I think there's a couple of things here, isn't there? I mean, there's no doubt that stress will have an impact on the emotions that people feel, normally arousal or fear. But some people will use the term stress to describe how they're feeling because they don't have a different word. Same with anxiety. Anxiety has a very kind of specific medical definition, but that doesn't necessarily mean that when someone says, "I'm feeling anxious," that doesn't mean that what they're saying is the same thing as what a doctor would say. Or if we are talking about anxiety, is your understanding of it the same as mine? And that kind of clouds everything. When we're talking about feelings, happy, we kind of know, you know, that's fairly universal. Sad, we know. Angry, okay. And then we get to anxious or stressed. And what do we mean by that? So I think there is certainly a link. There is no doubt that this will affect your emotions and feelings. But how we describe those things, I think that's a challenge.
And maybe something we can work with in school as well, sort of to develop vocabulary for feeling words.
Absolutely. I mean, it's done a lot in the younger years for certain. But I think as students get older, they experience more complex emotions. And I think one area that PSHE, I don't know if you have that in Sweden, so personal, social and health education, there'll be something along those lines. Something we can put into those lessons is the vocabulary in our school setting. Now, I think that allows students to articulate how they're feeling better. It allows them to articulate that to teachers and to each other. And even if it doesn't stop them feeling that way, at least we can discuss what that feeling is and therefore look at ways we can solve that, because constantly talking about stress and anxiety doesn't necessarily help us get any further in helping the students feel better. And so I agree with you. A kind of a vocabulary curriculum for emotions, feelings, that sort of thing is crucial, because otherwise we don't know what we're talking about. And slightly tangentially, when I teach psychology, we talk about the DSM and the ICD, and we look at its cross-cultural validity in terms of diagnosing mental health disorders. And there's huge issues with the way in which certain cultures describe how they feel and the words they use. And that means that diagnosing disorders across cultures is a minefield. And yet, we assume because we all speak the same language, we can describe the same things. I think that kind of filters into this idea of stress, that it's not really possible to kind of articulate the exact feelings and emotions without having that kind of shared vocabulary.
Yeah. In Sweden as well, we have something we call the social emotional learning. And that's sort of everything outside of the academic part of the school curriculum. So everyone works with it somehow, but not always that structure, or not always sort of evidence informed in a way.
Yeah.
Everyone has to work with it.
And I think it's really difficult, right? Because to be really evidence informed about stress, like, takes a significant amount of time and effort. And that's just one small part of the curriculum. What about consent? What about relationships? What about bullying, violence, racism, all those things? It's really difficult.
Yeah, I totally agree. And in your country, how is sort of the well-being among your school kids, your students? Was it a change of the pandemic, or did that affect, or was it?
The psychologist in me would avoid kind of making correlatory links without any control group. But the reality is, I think, look, there's no doubt that the pandemic has had an impact on students. But I think the real The real thing is that it's impacted students differently. You know, I work in a private school. The students that come to my school are generally more privileged, and with that comes certain, obviously, privileges during the pandemic in terms of access to food, space, those sorts of things. People, all of those things are different to students who attend different schools, and I think. However, what I think has been a challenge is the some students during a crucial period of their lives, you know, when they're going through puberty, when they're working out themselves, who am I, but also working out how do I interact with other people. You know, there's a lot of students, and I don't know what it was like in, I think Sweden was slightly looser on the lockdown rules, but in Germany there were very strict lockdown rules for a prolonged period of time, and the exam groups were allowed to come into school sooner. It made sense at the time. But those year groups that were kind of really developing physiologically and therefore psychologically during that time were socially very isolated. And so I don't think it's a surprise that we're seeing students struggle to interact with each other on certain levels. On some levels, they're great. You know, they were kept in close contact. You know, social media and kind of things like Zoom were great. But that kind of interpersonal relationship, the reading the body cues, the kind of expressing body cues, expressing body language has been really missed. So I would say that's the kind of the area where I see students from schools like ours really struggling, or struggling more than they used to. All students have always struggled with that. It's part of growing up, but I think that's an area that they've certainly struggled more with.
I think in Sweden, I have no evidence for it. Just my experience from those schools I've been talking to in my own school that we started to have challenges, I think, with absent students not feeling well before the pandemic as well. Then the pandemic made it worse for many students, and we are recovering from that. But we still have, I think, the biggest challenges. We're quite good in reaching academic results, but more challenges with the manage well-being and finding way to
Yeah, I mean, I
not feel
think.
well all the time, but to be able to sort of manage your own health.
And I think schools like ours have put a lot of effort into devoting time and curriculum efforts into helping students understand how to do that. And I think that's one of the kind of adaptations we've made to our curriculum is to say, look, we can see this happening. Let's change, right? Let's give students the tools to be able to cope with the day-to-day stresses of life. So we're back to stress again. It's about saying, look, this is what you may feel like. This is normal, but when it gets too much, these are the things you can do, and or these are the things you can do to prevent yourself feeling stressed. So that's certainly part of our curriculum now, more so than it was. And I think that's something schools need to adapt to.
Do you have a possibility in your school to sort of add the subject? Are you really fixed in the curriculum? This subject has to be, but is there an opening? If you would like to add an hour more every week in something, can you do
Germans would say "Jein," so a mixture of yes and no.
that?
Look, we have a fixed curriculum for maths, English, German, that. But we have kind of so we have quite a significant amount of PSHE, the social and emotional learning time, where we can be more flexible and respond to certain things. For example, when the Andrew Tate issues kind of were at the fore. We adapted our curriculum to address that. It's only right. You know, we adapt our curriculum to address the Israel-Palestine conflict. We adapted it to address the Ukraine-Russia conflict. We adapt it when something happens in school. We adapt it for that. And I think we have a little bit of wiggle room in that and our tutorial program to make sure we can adapt to the needs. I think a school that is fully inflexible puts itself in a position whereby it will miss opportunities to help the students learn outside of academic subjects.
In Sweden, you have a possibility to take some time from subjects, not from Swedish language, math, and English, but from other subjects, a few minutes, and form sort of the school's profile. But you need to
Okay.
apply to the government agency for schools and explain why is this different from, and why do you need this, and how is it different from regular subjects?
I see.
And
Yeah, we're
then
an independent school. We're a bit more flexible.
yeah. However, I think many schools put in some extra time that you can do with anything. But if you would like to not put in extra time, take from some other. And if you do a subject like this, you don't get grades in it. So you're not assessed. No.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think you could assess. I think that'd be very weird.
No, that would be strange. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
It would also be nice for the kids to have sort of an hour a week or some time. But it's just for them to help them manage all the subjects when they are graded all the time.
Absolutely. And it also affords opportunities for genuine discussion to kind of be led a bit more kind of on what's relevant to the students at this moment in time. And I think that's a really important part of a curriculum in the broadest sense of the term.
Yeah. Do you have some specific means or something you do to help your students manage stress? Something that is a sort of profile for what you're doing, your school, that is unique for you?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's unique for us. I think the irony being, and so this is, I think, the biggest takeaway from my entire talk that I gave at Research Ed on stress. One of the biggest things that causes stress in students' lives is exams, right? So, and a lot of what we do, we've just talked about assessed curricula, is prepare students for exams. And whether or not one likes, agrees, wants terminal exams, they're there.
So
the real question is what can we do as teachers and schools to kind of help prepare our students so that when these exams come, they're not so stressful. Now, obviously, the better someone knows the material, et cetera, but it's really interesting because the biggest study that kind of hit me really hard is a study by Smith et al. It's published in Science, so like one of the biggest, you know, journals is, back in 2016. And essentially, they did a whole host of kind of different groups, and they mixed and matched. So they had some control groups. But essentially, they demonstrated that if students learn, as in like revise material using retrieval practice, they still have the same stress response as someone who's kind of just reread their notes. But the impact of the stress on their recall is decreased. So they still get stressed. They still feel stressed, but they can recall much better. And for me, that study, if we only ever look at one study about stress and education, that for me is the biggest one, because it's telling us that, look, don't worry about whether the students feel stressed or not. Let's prepare them better and let them to do proper revision strategies that mean they know their stuff. And kind of it makes logical sense, right? If you're doing retrieval practice and you're actively kind of recalling things, and you know that before you go into the exam, you can recall it. Yeah. Well, of course, it's going to be easier to recall it in the exam. And I think so you ask, what do we do in our school? Well, in our school, the teachers use retrieval practice to help students revise. And one thing we've done over the last couple of years really is kind of explicitly teach specific revision strategies for each subject in lessons, right? So I would take out, you know, half an hour of my psychology lesson to say, right, this is how we're going to revise in psychology. Here are three options that we have, and we're going to practice them in class. And then you're going to do them at home, and then we're going to practice them again in class. And then, so when it comes to revision, you can do this. So I know you can do it, and I can guarantee you that it will reduce the impact of stress in the real thing. And then, you know, when we do that for each subject, and we do it in kind of that way, that's, I think, the biggest impact that our teachers, individual teachers, can have for students when it comes to reducing the impacts of stress on exams.
Yeah. So then you can say retrieval practice is a tool to coping with stress then.
Exactly.
And of course, get better results at the same time. Yeah.
Precisely. And I think, you know, people talk about retrieval practice. There are all kinds of kind of lethal mutations of it. But the fundamental kind of research on it, the fundamental idea of practicing recalling information, you know, it's the single biggest tool, the single biggest lever we have to reduce the impact of stress, for sure.
Yeah. If we stay in that area, do you also work sort of, if you have students with sort of small working memory, then you, of course, want to reduce the load in the working memory. Do you do any specifics to work on procedures for exams, for instance?
Yes. So again, you know, this is now becoming very, very subject specific, but certainly having kind of thinking patterns, for example, or, you know, giving students certain structures that they can remember, essay structures, for example, or helping students develop a tool that works for them, you know, if they want to, when they're in an exam, kind of how they plan their responses. Yes, although that typically, and this sounds awfully kind of as an easy cop out for me to say that it happens on an individual basis. The reality is that the students that have, significantly significant challenges with working memory tend to get a more bespoke program anyway, where those kinds of things are delivered by, for example, the SENCO, to help those students kind of organize their lives, but also organize their approach to exams, whereby they have a thinking process or a thinking pattern to help that kind of along the way. For sure, we need to reduce that kind of load in every situation, not just in exams, but certainly exams is really, really crucial.
Do you have any challenges? We have in Sweden, we're talking a lot about cell phones in school, or where for a long time as a principal, you can choose to don't have it or have it. In my school, for instance, they give them away during the lesson. Then it's
Oh.
grade 7 to 9 in Sweden.
Okay. We have a fairly simple rule. There are no mobile phones in school. So if it's seen by a member of staff, it gets confiscated for the rest of the day. So students aren't allowed phones in lessons. They're not allowed phones in the corridors. They're not allowed phones at break time. Yeah, that's our rule. Now, do I think students don't ever use their mobile phones? I'm sure that students use them in the toilets. We're not going to start policing that. However, if it, you know, if a student is using their mobile phone in the school day, and then they've sent a message to another student in the school, we can then act on that, obviously, like we would with any message. But yeah, no, we ban mobile phones for all the reasons that people ban mobile phones, and there's loads of evidence out there that just simply having your mobile phone is a big enough distraction, let alone kind of actually being able to use it. So yeah, we are a no phone school.
More and more schools in Sweden do the same, and maybe my school as well. We'll see. But so
Yeah,
far, so far
I
we
mean,
look
I think
excellent.
for me, the biggest challenge we have, if we're talking about non-academics, the biggest challenge we have socially is students' use of social media and messaging, right? So, lots of the conflict we have in school comes from students messaging each other on Snapchat, TikTok, WhatsApp, whatever it is. And even though in Germany the law is pretty clear that parents are responsible, and the law is very clear that parents have to check and take responsibility. There was a recent court ruling that says students under the age, so for example, WhatsApp, there's a legal age at which they can use this, and students under that age, parents have a legal obligation to check those messages. Despite that, obviously, parents are not doing it. I can understand. But the reality is that's where most of our conflict is coming from. And so anything we can do to reduce the impact of that in the school day can only be a benefit. And I think a lot of the work we're doing at the moment is upskilling parents and helping parents to have those challenging conversations with their children about social media use, and checking on what they post and what they message isn't about not trusting your child. It's about, I mean, in Germany at least, it's about upholding your legal responsibility and the moral responsibility, So yeah, I mean, I'm very much on the side of mobile phones for children are not great, but certainly in schools they have no place. But we do have a one-to-one device things, a one-to-one device policy in school. So, students get the kind of benefits of technology when the teacher wants them to. So,
They
I
can
wonder
control
how. Yeah, I was gonna say, I think if in a school that doesn't have that, there are many things that can be done with technology that are very useful and would therefore allowing students to use their mobile phone in class when a teacher says, be of benefit. I don't know. I still probably err on the side of no phones, but yeah.
If we talk about stress again. Now we talked about stress for students, but what about stress for teachers then? I mean, do any work on that as well?
I mean, I think the same principles apply, really. If we're talking about,
The same
what can we do
system, of
to
course.
same exactly, it's the same system. And I think, if we talk about things that are stressful for staff, obviously challenging meetings with students, parents, or each other, the key is to always lower the stakes. You know, we talk about, you know, one of the other things I talked about in my presentation is low stakes quizzing or low stakes testing is a really good kind of checking for understanding, assessment for learning type strategy that we can use that doesn't elicit a stress response. Well, if you're thinking about staff and kind of, I don't know how performance management works in Sweden, but, you know, staff, even the best staff in the world get stressed when it comes to being observed or, you know, having, you know, that's human nature. Why wouldn't we be stressed? We care about these things. But the lower the stakes are, the less stressful it is. And so, you know, having a kind of lower, so rather than saying this is a high stakes lesson observation, this is going to determine your pay for the next year, you know, that's awfully stressful. What we can say is we're going to take evidence from lots of different sources. We are going to use a more coaching approach to appraisals, that sort of thing, you know, to kind of de-stress the situation, certainly. But fundamentally, the mechanism or the kind of the process is the same in adults as it is in students. They're just not having to take exams.
No, true. If you look at research about sort of time management in schools, time stress is one of the biggest one for teachers, feeling inadequate. They don't have the time to do what they think they have to do.
But I think that comes, I think that's a leadership issue because
teaching
is one of those jobs that is never ending, right? You can always plan a bit more of your lesson. You can always give a bit more feedback. But I think leaders need to be very clear about expectations and say, look, this is where we need you to be. Have at it if you want to go above it. That's up to you, but you need to get to here, and here is okay. Right? Yeah. This is okay, and if you deliver this every day, then that's great. Because if you up the expectation to here, then people are always going to try and meet it, and there's only so many hours in the day. But as a leader, I would say, look, there's ways we can help with the time management. You know, centralized resources, centralized kind of detention system, centralized behavior management, centralized, you know, where you're utilizing the kind of organization, like the organization as a whole, to kind of benefit the individuals within it. So why have 10 people doing the same thing when you can have one person doing it and saves the work of 10 people? So those things are ways in which leaders can decrease that and at the same time develop good kind of habits. We want staff to collaborate, we want staff to talk. That decreases the stress, right? If you're talking to your colleagues about what's going on, well, you have a shared understanding. We come back to this kind of shared understanding and vocabulary, you know. Is this a stressful aspect? Well, is it stressful for someone else? Let's talk about what is the problem here. And actually, we might say, do you know what? This isn't stressful, or this is stressful, and let's try and do something about it. It helps us kind of get to that kind of outcome that we want.
Then we're taking sort of teachers and students. In Sweden, principals... Most principals I meet, school leaders, they love their work, but they're sort of burning in both ends. So in Sweden, many new school leaders, they stay in profession less than 3 years and then quit. Yeah, so that is not an optimal situation.
That's not good.
Not good. I agree.
I think it's probably similar in the UK as well. And I think so here's one of those. So part, we talked about stress and the high stakes nature of it, that, you know, The job is stressful, right? Being responsible for so many aspects of a school is stressful. And the question is how can we reduce that stress? So if we go back to the idea of retrieval practice being the, you know, the thing that helps students deal with exams, one of the biggest things I've found with our leadership team is preparing as a team as if we have an exam. So for example, one of the biggest stressful things is, you know, parent meetings, talking about safeguarding the parent meetings. We role play those things out. We workshop them. We talk to each other about them, because if we can practice them and we have tools at our disposal to be able to use under stress, then the actual act of doing it is less stressful. And there's some really interesting research about how under stress we shift our memory systems, right? So we move from kind of cognitive strategies to habitual strategies, which is not a surprise, really. We need to do things that we can do really quickly. Exactly. But so logically, therefore, we need to make sure that the cognitive strategies or tools that we want to use become habitual, because if they become habitual, we can do them under stress. So For me, one of the ways we can decrease the stress of leadership or teaching in general, it's about practicing and making a habit of those cognitive tools that we would always like to employ. So, you know, when we talk about asking questions, I'm talking about now interpersonal, you know, say in a stressful situation, we're talking about individual asking stressful questions for a safeguarding issue, for example, or we're having a really challenging conversation with a parent whereby we don't want to tell them, we just want to ask questions. If that's part of our habit, part of our nature, then under stress, we will continue to be able to do that. Whereas if we haven't practiced enough, you know, we go under stress, we shift our system, we shift the what we're going to be doing, and we become more likely to use those habits, good or bad, that we've had before. And so for me, again, this other aspect of stress and memory is really, really crucial. And that is, you know, making sure that things become habitual.
Yeah, interesting. A totally another question. Now you are already a school leader, but if you would be able to start a new school, you could recruit any teacher, do whatever you want, not limited in any case. What would be sort of the keys for success? What would the profile of your school? What would you focus at?
Cool. As in, how would I change? How would I do my recruitment process?
I could be, or it could be, I will focus on retrieval practice. I will
have
teachers that are excellent in building relations, or it could be anything.
honestly, so it's really interesting because I've been lucky enough to be in my job for this is my seventh year now, and I would have said when I started my role, I want teachers that have excellent subject knowledge that can utilize effective teaching and learning strategies. So, for example, can it utilize retrieval practice, know how to structure a task so that it challenges students appropriately at all levels, know how to develop positive relationships with students. But I've changed my mind. Those things are still important, really, really important.
Yeah.
But what I'd rather employ are staff that are willing to learn and are humble and reflective enough to be aware of their own challenges, because I would like to think that my leadership team and I are experienced and hopefully, fingers crossed, he says, good enough at our jobs to be able to train someone to use retrieval practice.
Yeah.
I hope I can train someone to become a good coach. I hope I can train, you know, with the help of external agencies, with the help of colleagues, but I hope that within our school as we have now, that we can upskill staff to design better tasks. We can upskill staff to assess better. We can upskill staff to do all of these things better. What I find the most challenging, and maybe this is a reflection on me more than a reflection on teachers, I find it more difficult to upskill staff to want to be better. I find it more difficult to upskill staff to say, do you know what? Hands up, I'm not very good at this. Let's go away. Let's put the hard yards in. Let's read loads of research. Let's think about this deeply. Let's discuss with my colleagues. Let's try something new, because that's a lot of work, right? Yeah. Especially the reading of the research bit.
Yeah, I agree.
That, you know, even if someone wants to work and improve, I think sometimes people go, oh, I see, you know, Mr. X over there and Mrs. X over there doing these things. Oh, it must be quite easy. They don't see the kind of the underlying hard work that's gone into it. And then they get there and they're like, oh, this is difficult. Do I want to be doing it? And it's that I find really difficult. Maybe because I don't have enough time. I don't know. But that's the thing I find the most difficult. So if you're going to ask me what sort of staff would I want, I would want staff that are desperate to learn, want to improve, and are willing to do the work that's needed. Because I think teaching is very trainable. I think the actual art of being a teacher is trainable. But I think the mindset of wanting to learn is more difficult to teach.
Yeah. Interesting. Do you think also that sort of, you can say the leadership in the classroom is very trainable? Of course, you can train strategies, because some teachers, they don't know why it works, but it just simply works all the time.
Yeah.
They sort of own their classroom just naturally.
I think it is trainable, but that's because I think children by and large are very nice and children by and large want to learn. Now that's not to say that all teachers can always work in all classrooms. I don't know, but I think as a general kind of, if we're talking about a general kind of average, yes, I think being able to manage and lead that classroom, I think that is also trainable. Yes. As
I
long
agree.
as the culture of the school is right, though. So
Yeah,
getting someone
I
to be an
agree.
island, I think it's a team effort. I think behavior management in the classroom is not a reflection necessarily on a given teacher. I mean, if a teacher sees two kids talking all the time and they never stop and they don't separate them, that's on the teacher. But I think if, you know, if there's not a good culture of, you know, all hands up, no hands up, there's not a good culture of turn and talk, those sorts of things, they are school-wide, they are cultural things, and I think therefore it's trainable.
Yeah, I agree on that as well. And of course, you have talents in different areas, and some have talents in that area. So it's quite
of
natural.
Course, yes.
I wonder. I had finished, but I came up with a new question because I was thinking: do you focus also sort of, because you talk about the team effort, do you focus sort of intentionally on collective efficacy in your school?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge thing for me. Is the school is more than the sum of its parts, and but every single part has a role to play. For me, focusing professional development, focusing our school strategic, I suppose, goals.
Yeah.
They have to reflect that this is a collective effort. This kind of appreciating that the success of students or the success of staff or the success of the school is about us all working together. And so we try to be cohesive where possible. The challenge for that is when that cohesion kind of limits the autonomy of individuals. And for me, it's about finding that balance of, okay, well, yes, I appreciate that for one person this might not work, but it's beneficial for five. So almost a utilitarian approach to that. However, if that one person's gripes or complaints or concerns are actually really valid, then they're not ignored. And we say, okay, do you know what? Actually, maybe we have to be cohesive the other way. And I think in terms when it comes to teaching, we devolve a lot of that responsibility to departments. They are collectively responsible for the teaching in their subjects. And when it comes to cross-curricular things like behavior management and things like that, then we go wider, and it is a collective responsibility of all the heads of department and all the senior managers.
That's interesting. You have said so many interesting things that is great for the listeners, but
I hope
do
so.
You have any final words? Because I'm really happy. I think this was a really interesting talk for myself as well, and I'm sure for the listeners.
Thank you very much. I mean, I've really enjoyed speaking. Thank you very much for having me on. I've nothing necessarily more to say. I think stress, for me, the one thing I haven't really touched on about stress, and I did want to say it at some point, is that stress certainly can help the learning process. So there is most of the research shows that if people are stressed when they're learning, it's actually not necessarily negative. It can be positive. And I think that's kind of an underappreciated element of stress, is that it can help that learning process. It is very, very negative for the recall process, which is why we talked about retrieval practice. But I think, you know, something else that I think listeners might find useful, and they're more than welcome to message me or whatever, and I can send them the literature. You know, stress when encoding is actually beneficial. And I think it's the stress when recalling aspect that we need to kind of reduce. And so teachers shouldn't necessarily get too hung up about, is this a stressful situation for my students when they're learning this difficult, complex math problem? Because actually, that might end up being beneficial. That's not to say we should stress the kids out by putting loads of pressure on them, but, you know, the actual stress of learning isn't necessarily that bad. But I think that's probably it. Otherwise, I think, you know, I hope your listeners appreciate some of the things. And if they want to find out more, then please message me or you, and we can give them some more literature to read.
Okay, thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you.